Hello, and welcome to our latest episode of Memcast. My name is Dr. Thomas Bond, and in today's episode, we're going to be discussing HLH, or hemophagocytic lymphohistiocytosis. We want to talk a little bit about what that means and how we define HLH. We're going to talk a little bit about the mechanism of the condition and who gets HLH. And we want to talk a little bit about when to suspect HLH and what to do if we do start thinking that a patient could have HLH. Very lucky today to talk through all of this with us. We've got Dr. Tattersall. She's a consultant in adolescent and adult rheumatology and also the co-chair of HIHASC, which is the Hyperinflammation and HLH Cross Specialty Collaboration. So we've got a veritable expert on our hands here. So thank you very, very much for joining us, Dr. Tattersall.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure, pleasure. So I guess the first thing is, what is HLH? Because it's for some people that maybe they've not heard of it or it just came up in a lecture once. What are we talking about with HLH?
So HLH is either a brilliant or terrible name, whichever you look at it, for the immune chaos or hyperinflammation, which can be induced by lots of conditions, but primarily infection, often by cancer, particularly hematological malignancy, rheumatic disease, which is why rheumatologists often lead on HLH, and increasingly by therapy modes like CAR T-cell therapy or immunotherapy. So as you've quite rightly said, HLH stands for hemophagocytic lymphohistiocytosis, and I often describe to patients that hemophagocytic describes the phenomenon where blood cells are inappropriately gobbled up by phagocytic cells or macrophages in the system, and lymphohistiocytosis is just a complicated way of saying immune system activation. So what we are describing in this condition is a trigger for the immune system, the reasons that I've already said, causing what's initially usually an appropriate immune response, immune activation to clear the antigen or to attack the cancer. But then in some people, for some reason that we don't really understand, the negative feedback that would normally switch off the immune system fails and the immune system goes into overdrive. And that's a phenomenon of hyperinflammation, which in its purest form fits some criteria for HLH, which we can discuss. And this whole issue has got much easier in the post-COVID era, because the reason primarily that people died in the first wave of COVID, when they didn't die purely of a pneumonic illness, they died of the localized hyperinflammation or localized HLH in their lungs, which COVID induced. And so terms like cytokine storm, which describe that immune chaos and hyperinflammation, were even seen on the front page of the newspaper. And we now routinely give people with COVID dexamethasone, steroids, and baricitinib and tocilizumab, profound immune suppression on the general medical wards when they have evidence of hyperinflammation, because we know it saves lives. So that's a very long and complicated way of saying HLH is an immune response to a trigger. And the key thing is you have to recognize it, you have to treat both the cytokine storm, and then identify and treat the trigger. And that's where we as doctors come in.
Well, that's sort of interesting that you mentioned how COVID brought a lot of this to the fore. And do you feel like this is something that maybe in the past has gone under-recognized and flown under the radar, and maybe it's more common than we think?
Yeah, it's definitely more common than we think. And it's so interesting. If I was doing this discussion face to face, there would be people in the discussion who I would see suddenly thinking, oh, that's what that patient died of. So the clinical scenario is that the HLH is characterized by three things. It's characterized by a persistent fever, by falling blood counts because of the hemophagocytosis, this inappropriate activation of macrophages gobbling up blood cells, and a raised ferritin, which is a marker of macrophage activation. So HLH is characterized by the three Fs: falling counts, fever, and ferritin. And so the patient often actually looks as if they've got sepsis. And the reason that the scales fall from people's eyes when we talk about it is everybody remembers a patient, often a young patient, who seemed to have sepsis, had lots and lots of antibiotics, lots and lots of treatment, went to ITU and died. And people just said it's overwhelming sepsis. And sepsis is an immune response to infection. And so what a hyperinflammation specialist like me is looking for is those patients where that fever, the falling blood counts, and the profoundly raised ferritin are telling us that, yes, it might be infection that's the trigger, but the immune system's gone into overdrive and it needs treatment on its own. And that clinical picture has definitely been missed in the past. And we've got lots of data that shows that it's under-recognised and that people should be picking it up more. And anecdotally, if we get there, I can tell you about the pathway that we follow in my hospital and how that's increased early pickup. Undoubtedly, the earlier you pick this up and think, hang on, could this patient have HLH? I'll just check the three Fs. And the quicker you treat, the less treatment they need and the better the survival rate. And the reason we're always keen to talk about HLH is that untreated, a HLH carries a prognosis of death of 50 to 70%. Prognosis is much improved with recognition and treatment, but this is a profoundly worrying diagnosis. And so if you only ever pick up and treat one in your career, you will have done that patient an enormous favour.
So, I think what you're saying is we need to know exactly how to tease these patients out from our sepsis patients, because actually, on the face of things, it might look quite similar. So, could you tell us a little bit about how do we go about? We've got our index of suspicion up. You've mentioned it. We're looking for it everywhere. How are we going to find it in these patients?
So I think the key things are I've seen patients labelled PUO, pyrexia of unknown origin, or antibiotic resistant fever. So the markers for me are somebody who's got a persistent fever, and I'm talking usually a high grade fever, 38.5 or above. And instead of swinging, as it often does with sepsis, you often see with infection as it evolves into sepsis, you often see fever, which, yes, it goes up to 40, but then it settles. What you see is a switch from that swinging fever to a persistent fever. The antibiotics really make no difference to the patient. The patient continues to get worse. And if you look at the blood count trends for infection, usually we expect a really profound bone marrow response. We expect the bone marrow to be pouring out blood cells to fight the infection. And what you see is actually what appear to be normal or slightly lower than normal blood counts, and they tend to fall. So if you look at them over the last 3 days, perhaps the platelet count's gone 230, 180, 130. And so that falling count pattern. And often if they've got a low hemoglobin, a ferritin happens to have been checked, and you can look and see a normal ferritin's 300, 400, 500 in the context of sepsis. But when it's kind of 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, and certainly if it's over 10,000 in a patient with a fever, you should be looking for reasons this is not HLH rather than reasons that it is. So the typical pattern, and to be a bit facetious, when the patient's got what's thought to be an antibiotic resistant fever, and you've already been asked to put a referral into ID, to haematology, and to rheumatology, you should be thinking, hang on, what's happening here? And then the hard markers are the fever and the pattern of the fever, the blood counts in sepsis or profound infection or in profound inflammation. If the patient's got lupus, for example, you expect the blood count, the platelet count to be high, not low. So always really worry if the platelet count's low. And if this patient appears to have no unifying diagnosis, but they're getting worse, particularly if they're tachycardic or they've got evidence of multi-organ failure. Because I should have said the problem about the cytokine storm is that it causes multi-organ failure. If they start to develop organ failure, you should really be thinking about HLH. And the other practical pointer is that occasionally patients have very high inflammatory markers, but often these patients seem to have a CRP or particularly an ESR, which just doesn't fit. Their ESR is only 30 or 40, and they look really sick. And that's another marker of HLH, this inappropriate inflammatory response.
So you've talked a bit about some other things we can keep our eyes out for. Doing a bit of reading around it, there's a couple of scores, diagnostic criteria that have come up. Do you use those a lot, things like the H score or the 2004 criteria? What about that is sort of relevant for us as we go to diagnose these patients?
Yeah, the original descriptions of HLH were in children born with a genetic error, which meant they couldn't switch off their immune systems, and those children have primary HLH. Primary HLH is best diagnosed using the primary HLH score, which is the HLH 2004 score. It has a couple of things in it that we don't routinely measure or can't measure in practice. One is natural killer cell activity, and one is the soluble CD25. Those are highly specialized tests and take several weeks to come back. The much more pragmatic and evidence-based score in adults, so 16 and above, is the H score. And this isn't a diagnostic score, it's a calculator of probability of HLH. So you need to take a patient with a reasonable pretest probability of HLH, so that patient we've described with the antibiotic resistant fever, and you input on H-score website or MedCalc or any of these places that you've populated the drop-down boxes, and they're really sensible drop-down boxes. And most patients have had all the investigations. So it's the fever, ferritin, a fibrinogen, because this inappropriate cytokine storm gobbles up coagulation factors, liver function, whether they've got a big spleen or a big liver. And you can put, I don't know, if you don't know. In the H score is a bone marrow aspirate. That's the score is weighted. And if you play with the score, it makes almost no difference whether you get hemophagocytosis on the bone marrow or not. And so you do not need a bone marrow to make this diagnosis. It's mainly made on the things which you'll already have, I guarantee, for most patients. You might not have a fibrinogen, but I bet you have everything else. And you can put not known and you get a score. And if the patient's got the clinical picture and a H score of 50%, which is an absolute value of 169 in the score, but 50% or above, they should be treated. Because what you're doing is saying, how likely is it with this clinical pattern and these values that the patient has a hyperinflammatory illness? And if it's more than 50% likely, you should treat.
Okay. So just before we get to that treatment, you've mentioned the things in the H score, which are obviously investigations we should be doing. And I guess in these patients, we might be speaking to hematology for a bone marrow. Are there any other investigations before we get to that point that you would want people to do?
So it's a really great question. So all I want is the things that the H score says apart from a bone marrow. If I get a call, could this be HLH? I want to know the fever, the count, the blood counts, and the ferritin. Triglycerides are part of the H-score, and they're really useful. They're another measure of macrophage activation. But there's a couple of catches. If the patient's on ITU and receiving propofol, you can't interpret the triglyceride result. And the coagulation, often these patients are labelled as having DIC, whereas in fact what they have is a hypofibrogenemic, so a lack of fibrogen-driven coagulopathy. You're still going to support them, but you have to switch off the HLH, otherwise the fibrinogen will be consistently low as a marker of macrophage activation, and you will never get on top of the coagulation unless you treat the HLH. And one of the most difficult things to persuade people is that you have, once you've got a cytokine storm, and COVID is just a perfect example of this, once you've got a cytokine storm, you have to treat the storm separate to the trigger. In COVID, we know what the trigger is, and we can't actually treat COVID, but we can give antivirals if patients are immune suppressed or whatever. But the reality of this is this patient comes in, they've been completely well, they're suddenly not well, you don't know what the trigger is, and you have to treat them. So if you phone me, I will say, on balance, how likely is a cytokine storm? And I'll ask you a few questions and we'll do a H-score. And I will say to you, the priority for now is to treat the cytokine storm. The priority for the next 24 hours is to understand the trigger. And then you're into things like an abdominal ultrasound or cross-sectional imaging to confirm hepatosplenomegaly, PET scan if you've got a PET scanner available. But sometimes these patients are so sick that really, again, not in any way to be facetious or disrespectful, but you've got to treat the cytokine storm to keep the patient alive to make the diagnosis of why they ever had the cytokine storm. And that's why we love to do podcasts and talks like this, because the people who are best at picking up that are the front door medics, and the front door medics are often exactly your target group. So please remember, if you see a patient who's got a fever, nobody knows what's going on, the patient seems to be getting worse, not better with treatment, just think three F's. Have I looked at the fever chart? Have I done a ferritin? And have a look not just at the absolute value of the blood counts, but at the trend. And then you can make an assessment, and then you can have a discussion about the probability of them needing treatment for a cytokine storm while you do everything else they might need as well. Be very, very wary of the patient with HLH who has tachycardia, because the heart in particular does very badly with cytokine storms, and they often have a myocarditis. And the feared complication of HLH, one of the reasons that people die, is they suddenly go into acute cardiogenic shock. And it's because the heart muscle has been stunned by the cytokine storm. So be very, very wary of a patient you're phoning me about because you think they've got HLH, And if you tell me the pulse is 130, I'm going to be saying you need to call critical care.
It's really, really interesting everything you're saying. Like you said, this is probably far more common than we think, and everything you say makes you think about patients you've seen. And also the fact that you mentioned DIC, I feel like that's one of the complications that we learn about, and everyone's on the lookout for that, but not so many people I think would be on the lookout for this. So it's good to get that information. We've talked a little bit about how we're going to spot these patients. So the big question is, now we've spotted them, you've alluded to it a couple of times, I guess we're calling you. What do we do with these patients?
Yeah, I mean, who you call differs in different hospitals. One of the reasons that HLH is a terrible name is because it sounds like a weird, esoteric hematological syndrome. And if you phone hematologists, often their response is, I don't do HLH, because they will be thinking of the primary HLH that children have. So to answer the question about treatment, let's consider that tiny baby with a genetic inborn error. Every time they get a mild infection, they go into full-blown cytokine storm. What we do for those children is we profoundly immune suppress them to stop the hyperinflammation, the immune overdrive, to get them well enough to have a curative procedure to reprogram their immune system. That's a stem cell transplant. So everything we know about treating adults with acquired HLH, they don't have a genetic problem, but they've acquired an immune dysregulation, comes from that model. And so the answer is you need to give profound immune suppression to suppress the cytokine storm. And that can be a really hard sell in somebody who's sick in multi-organ failure. So the answer is you call whoever you think might be helpful. In our hospital, we have a HLH MDT. I lead that, but if I'm not there, we have a trust guideline. We say, do the H score. If it's above this in this condition, give immune suppression. I'll come to what that is and refer into the HLH MDT. In other hospitals, it may be that you call hematology. It may be that you call rheumatology. And so one of the homework for people listening to the Memcast is, who would I call if I knew that a patient had HLH? And the treatments are steroids, just like COVID. Everybody gets dexamethasone. But our patients with HLH usually get pulsed intravenous methylprednisolone. A rheumatologist always reaches for IV methylpred in a disaster, and that's no different. So usually patients receive 3 days of a gram of methylprednisolone a day. Sometimes you attenuate that dose if the patient's very little, and really you're aiming for about 10 milligrams per kilogram. We don't see many adults less than 40 or 50 kilograms, so it's somewhere between 500 milligrams to a gram of methylprednisolone day one, day two, day three. There is a drug called anakinra, which is an interleukin-1 blocker, and interleukin-1 is the main driver of the cytokine storm. And in October of 2021, we led a commissioning policy to get anakinra available in any hospital for this indication of HLH. This is a subcutaneous injection, although the drug can be given intravenously if the patient's really sick, and it's a direct interleukin-1 blocker. And if the patient either doesn't respond to that initial steroid, or they respond and you need to continue treatment, you start anakinra. And usually we start around 2 to 4 milligrams per kilogram in divided doses a day. And this supersedes previous treatment where we used to use intravenous immunoglobulin, IVIG, which has become a very shortage specialty drug, which in NHS England's view, the reason they allowed funding for anakinra was it saved intravenous immunoglobulin for people with immune deficiency who need it to sustain life. But you can, if the HLH is refractory and doesn't get better with steroids and anakinra, add another drug called cyclosporine, which helps stabilize T cells, or add intravenous immunoglobulin. So the treatment for this is profound immune suppression with steroids, anakinra initially, and then refractory disease, you require cyclosporine, intravenous immunoglobulin, and in conjunction with your hematology colleagues, and probably well beyond the scope of this Memcast, a drug called etoposide, which can knock out activated macrophages. But front door, it's steroids, which will keep the patient alive. And there's often big resistance to people who are not familiar with HLH to giving sick patients steroids. And my comeback to that is that if we identify somebody with pneumococcal meningitis, we treat them with antibiotics, but we also give dexamethasone 10 milligrams 4 times a day for 10 days, which is a heroic dose of steroid, but is evidence-based to save lives, almost certainly because what you're doing is switching off the hyperinflammation in the meninges, which causes the damage. So that's my comeback if people tell me that I'm crazy. And in fact, in our hospital and our region now, this is so much a part of day-to-day use that people now phone me up and say, I've started steroids. Can you come and give an opinion? So early recognition, early treatment with standard drugs. Please do not ever write up 1 gram of methylpred without writing up a PPI and Adcal or calcium and D3 supplement of your choice, because these patients will not thank you if they then have an enormous GI bleed.
You keep answering questions that I'm about to ask as well. So it's very good. It's saving me a job. I agree with what you're saying. Obviously, it's not to the same doses, but we treat infective exacerbations of COPD with steroids routinely, and that, people don't necessarily think of that as an immunosuppressive thing, but it is. There was a couple of things you mentioned. I might be sort of going backwards a little bit, but you were talking about when people call you, people have a sepsis or a syndrome that looks like it could be HLH. And then you talked about certain patients or certain conditions that have it. Obviously, there's the completely well patient who gets septic and has an overactivation of their immune system. But what patients are more at risk?
But great question. So, patients with rheumatic disease, particularly systemic lupus erythematosus or Still's disease, classically go into HLH. And about 10 or 15%, both of patients with lupus and with Still's disease, present their first time in HLH. They present really sick and are often labelled as infected. But when you go back, they had an episode of HLH, which, because they were given steroids to treat the new lupus or the new Still's, switched off the HLH. Hematological malignancy. So if a patient comes in HLH query cause, in my head, they've got lymphoma till proven otherwise, because lymphoma is a potent driver of HLH and it also has the poor prognosis. CAR T cell therapy, which is increasingly the immune therapy of choice for both hematological malignancy, but now things like multiple sclerosis, increasingly in lupus, actually requires a degree of cytokine storm to show that it works. So you program the patient's own T cells to destroy bits of their immune system effectively. That's probably get shot by a hematologist for saying that. But a marker of success of CAR T cell treatment is an element of cytokine release syndrome. So they actually don't think their treatment's worked if they don't get a bit of hyperinflammation. A proportion of those patients do get classical HLH, and they are treated, interestingly, not with anakinra, but with tocilizumab, which is an interleukin-6 blocker. But I mean, the message is there are cytokine blockers that can be used to treat HLH. And then infection worldwide is the commonest cause. And the reason that people die of dengue, for example, is because they develop HLH. If you acquire dengue fever, just like COVID, a number of people have actually a relatively mild illness, self-limiting. People who die of dengue have enormous viral load, a very high ferritin, and exhibit features of HLH. And there's currently an ongoing trial in Vietnam looking at those patients, a bit like we did in COVID. If you've got a CRP of 75 and we give you tocilizumab, do you live more than if you didn't, of giving those patients anakinra? And in this country, the really big viruses that really give HLH are Epstein-Barr virus and HIV. And the infection, which, if the patient hasn't got lymphoma and hasn't got a rheumatic disease, I'm always asking, where's the TB? Because TB-associated HLH is increasingly recognised. So those are the, and that's why it can come into any medical specialty, or in fact, surgical specialty. If people come in collapsed, sometimes there's a question, have they bled out into their abdomen? And they sometimes come in on the surgical take. So this presentation can present to any doctor anywhere. And that's why, in the same way, we're all very alert for the signs of sepsis. It's not unreasonable to just be thinking, well, if it's not sepsis, could it be immune overactivation, hyperinflammation? I don't care if you don't call it HLH, but just recognizing that phenomenon of the cytokine storm. Has the immune system gone wrong here? And do I need to treat the immune system to get the patient well enough to understand what their trigger was?
It sounds like there's sort of a few tiers then, I guess, in that you've got your initial, like you said, have you identified the overinflammation, the hyperinflammation, getting that treatment started, and then I guess the raft of tests that would come to identify those triggers that you've just talked about. Obviously, there's I guess, a huge raft of complications potentially from HLH. If you can go into multi-organ failure, there's a lot of reasons why people might need to go to ICU. Is there anything that we particularly need to be aware of, anything we should be monitoring when we're trying to treat these patients?
Yeah, so pulse rate and cardiovascular status, the commonest reason that the commonest thing that happens is the patient seems fine. Critical care come down and say the patient's fine. What's the problem? Critical care are walking back up to critical care and the patient arrests. And I'm really not joking. I mean, I've seen that, and that's because tachycardia you really worry about. It's a marker of myocardial irritability, and myocarditis is a really worrying sequelae of HLH. The other problem is the other organ that really cannot cope with being bathed in cytokines is the brain. So confusion. So at the bedside, the patient who's got tachycardia and is not quite themselves or is a bit confused and has got a ferritin over 10,000, which is the kind of that's the if you ever see a ferritin over 10,000, I really want you to tell me why that's not HLH. Not ask me if it is. There are some things which can cause that, but they're usually profound liver necrosis. You know, if you've had lots of transfusions, your baseline ferritin might be 3,000 or 4,000. It's not 10,000. If you've got profound liver disease, unless you've acutely decompensated and you've actually got liver necrosis, the ferritin will not be 10,000. So, you know, those simple bedside, this is basic medicine. Is the patient ill or well? And if they've got a tachycardia and they're confused, genuinely, in our trust, that is a trigger for critical care referral. Because we know those are poor prognostic indicators. I've also seen ARDS, rarely kidney failure, really rarely. For some reason, the kidneys can tolerate a cytokine storm. And we found that in COVID as well. People didn't go into acute renal failure with COVID. We don't know why, but they didn't. And it seems to be very similar. I have seen renal failure with HLH, but it's unusual. But ARDS is not unusual. So, and then you get called to ITU. We simply don't know why this patient's in multi-organ failure, but somebody's done a ferritin and it's come back and it's 30,000. Okay, well, I think we do know then.
So thank you so much. You've gone through there. We've talked about the kind of patients that are going to get HLH, how we recognize it, and the key signs to keep an eye out for, investigations we can do, and we've talked exactly about how we're going to treat these patients as well. I've got a vague guess of what it might be, but I wanted to ask you, do you have like some real take-home messages, things that you want people to make sure they remember from listening to this episode?
If you see a patient and they've had multiple opinions and they have a fever and nobody knows what's wrong with them, please think three Fs. Is the fever persistent? Are their blood counts falling? They might be normal, but the trend is down or frankly abnormal. Please check a ferritin. Ferritin can be turned around within an hour and certainly within 4 hours in any hospital, which requires a call to the lab. Can you please make sure the ferritin is titrated out? It's no use to me if it just says greater than 5,000. I want to know if it's 5,000, 15,000, or as I have seen in the last week, 105,000. And the reason that's important is that when you treat patients, a drop in the ferritin of 20 to 50% over the first few days of treatment is a good prognostic indicator. So pick up the phone to the lab and add on a ferritin. And a really good trick is if you suddenly get a high ferritin, 9,000, phone the lab and see if they've got any clin chem specimens they can just check a ferritin on from a day or a couple of days ago. And if the ferritin was 1,000 a couple of days ago and it's 9,000 today, that's a really good potential marker of hyperinflammation. So HLH is a lot about trends and patterns. And that's why, if you're a good bedside medic, almost nothing that I've described requires any fancy tests. And most of this is putting together the clinical picture from tests that have already been done and recognizing the pattern. Can I just say, we run a national MDT weekly. You can search for us on the interweb. You can join our HIHASC organization, again, www.hihasc.org, hosted by the charity Histio UK. That's a meeting of like-minded professionals four to six times a year just to discuss for an hour each time cases and so on. But a group of us run a national MDT, and you'll see on the internet that patients can be referred in, and we've got a number of guidelines. So if you suddenly find yourself in an unfamiliar hospital or a hospital where people don't know about this and you want some advice, there's a national MDT with all the appropriate governance in place where your patient can be discussed. And we, myself and my co-chair, Dr. Jessica Manson, who runs the identical service in London, I'm based in Sheffield, will provide that ad hoc, and our teams will provide that ad hoc advice and support between the formal meetings, which are every week in themselves. So this is not something you're alone for. There's plenty of support.
So if we are struggling for advice, if we have a look at that website, the resources and things are all there, and we can get the information we need. Brilliant. Well, that's excellent. Thank you so, so much for coming on and talking about this. It's been really, really interesting, really enlightening. About 7, 20, 100 of the questions I want to ask, but I think I'll run out of time. But it's been really, really good. So thank you very much.
Thanks for inviting me.
No problem. Just a last reminder as well, if you haven't looked at the Instagram, we'll have some MCQ questions on there all about HLH. I'm sure if you couldn't answer them before, now they'll be the easiest thing to look at. And we're going to have our next episode out next Friday. So thank you very much for listening.